Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very happy that we can begin our broadcast week of the morning show with a couple of very good friends of the morning show who have been on any number of times before. Dr. Thomas Carr is from the faculty at Carthage College, and he heads up the paleontology program at Carthage. And we've talked with Dr. Carr on quite a few occasions about the dinosaur digs in which he has been involved out west in Montana, and also just the ongoing work of the paleontology program and the kind of things that his students have been exploring. Also with us quite a number of occasions has been his preparator, Dr. Megan Seitz, who's been with the program for quite a number of years, and has someone working with her now, Andrew Gable, a Carthage grad from 2020, who is now the second preparator for the program. And we think perhaps at some point we might have a couple of Carthage students appearing as well, as thus far they are still missing in action, but Maverick Lear and Joseph Krekora, who received SURE grants to do some research over this past summer. And even in their absence, we will talk about what that all means and the kind of work that they were doing. We welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you.
Good to have all of you here. Dr. Carr, I think this would be kind of a nice opportunity to just get kind of a general historical sketch of just how long there has been a paleontology program at Carthage. And remind us of when you were hired by Carthage, and if at that point in time you were hired with a paleontology program already in place, or was that something that you, in effect, needed to create?
Yeah, so today the Carthage paleo program is 12 undergraduate students strong. That places us probably in the top three of undergraduate paleo programs in North America and the UK.
Wow.
If you take the percentage of paleo students relative to the entire undergraduate student body, we're a big program, and thankfully we're at a period of time where we have the staff for that. So as you mentioned, Dr. Seitz is a permanent staff at the lab downtown at Dinosaur Discovery Museum. We've recently hired Andrew, and we saw Brady Holbach move on to Alberta, and we've been lucky to have the money to support to keep that second preparator position going. The whole thing started back in 2004. There was no program. There was an empty building that's, you know, the former KPM, Kenosha Public Museum, which is now Dinosaur Discovery Museum. And it took till 2007 to get the main exhibit in the public gallery up to show the evolution of birds through meat eating dinosaurs. The field program started in 06, and that was just me with a maximum of, you know, two or three students. So there was a lot of heavy lifting there in the early days. But we managed to collect a whole bunch of dinosaur bones, a lot of our fossils, which justified the hire of a permanent staff to run the lab and help co-lead the field program. So Dr. Seitz was hired in 2011. And since then, our numbers of paleo students have steadily grown, so that we've had an upward trend since then. Of course, there's a bit of variance. Last fall, we were at 14 students, and we've dipped by two, but that's basically a rounding error for us. So we're in good shape. We had a good start, and we are trying to keep that going into the future.
When Carthage hired you, was it in part with the intention of a paleontology program being started? I mean, was that a concerted intention of the college right from the start, from the moment they hired you?
Yeah, it sure was. The whole paleo program, the cooperation between the city and Carthage, was dreamed up by Mayor Antramian and President Greg Campbell. And it was their idea to have a dinosaur museum, specifically a dinosaur museum, as part of the museum complex in Kenosha. And I was hired specifically to basically teach comparative anatomy on campus and get the paleo program going, which included, the expectation was, field, lab, and an academic track. And I had all of that in place by the end of 2006.
Not bad. I didn't sit around. So, Dr. Megan Seitz, I think Dr. Carr said you came aboard at in the year 2011. This is probably as good a moment as any to for you to remind us about kind of your own professional background, maybe the impetus for you to become interested in this field in the first place, and what maybe specifically drew you to the work of being a preparator.
Yes, thank you. I've always had an interest in nature and history in general, and paleontology was a lovely meeting of those two. I've always enjoyed national parks and that kind of outdoor activity, and then getting to see dinosaurs, mammoths, extinct organisms of all kinds and all ages is just a wonderful thing to be able to do for a living. Then at the museum, my main job is to take care of the fossils we have. It's not just enough to go out and get a bunch of fossils in Montana every year. They do require some care to keep them for the future, to keep them for exhibits, for study by researchers around the country. And I'm trying to preserve the bones, make sure they're in the best shape we can possibly get them, and also serve to educate the public. The museum is open to view through windows so that the people who come to the museum get to see the lab, get to see real science in action, both done by me, done by Andrew now as a preparator, and students and community members too.
Fantastic. This is a good time to meet Andrew. Andrew Gable, a graduate of Carthage College from 2020. So I think this is your first visit to the program, right?
This is. Thank you
for having me. So we need to learn a whole lot about you before we talk about this new position that you have just taken. You were telling me before we went on the air that you are originally from Partyville. Tell us about growing up in Partyville, Wisconsin, and in particular, anything that would be a clue of in terms of where you've ended up now.
Sure. Okay. And also, excuse me, I got a little bit of a cough right now. Mm-hmm. Partyville is a small rural town. It's about 45, 50 minutes north of Madison, Wisconsin. So I didn't necessarily grow up very close to many museums or anything like that, except on occasional trips to Madison or something like that. But just being exposed to paleontology from an early age through books and other media. The Walking with Dinosaurs series came out when I was like four or five. That was very formative for me, among other things. The Walking with Beasts as well. I feel like most people entering this career in my generation can probably cite similar influences. Things took a little bit of a detour. I studied something else when I was at Carthage. I was a double major in classical archaeology and political science with a minor in Latin. That was in some ways kind of a passing interest. I sort of had a, not to disparage that in the least, but I sort of had, in my own personal life, a kind of misplaced sense of youthful idealism, I guess you could say. I just wasn't really cut out for that, and I eventually realized that this is where my interests truly lie, and this is what I plan to continue to pursue.
Very good.
So I am very thankful for this opportunity that Dr. Carr and Seitz have given me here as well.
Right. So even though at Carthage you were a classical archaeology student and a political science student,
yes,
you also had some involvement in the paleontology program.
I did. The summer of 2016 was my first time going out to Montana for the field session, and then I went there again as a volunteer last summer.
So you've dipped your toe, and in that work, did you see Dr. Seitz in action? I mean, or what was your introduction to what a preparator does?
I did also work at the Mammoth site of Hot Springs. I did see Dr. Seitz and Dr. Carr in the field, but I didn't see them doing any preparation. I wasn't working in the museum yet at that point, but I worked at the Mammoth site of Hot Springs, South Dakota, the summer of 2017. So I was exposed to a little bit of fossil preparation as a part of that. At that point in time, there were two different internships. There was the conservation internship and the educational internship. I had the latter, and there wasn't much fossil preparation that was involved in that. That was mostly the former. But after going on the next field session that I went on, shortly thereafter, I asked Dr. Seitz about volunteering at the museum. So I've been doing that since, I believe, September of 2022. Yeah. So I've been doing that from then until when I started this paid position at the museum.
Very good. And so, Dr. Seitz, is that kind of where the primary training has occurred for Andrew?
Yes, having him as a volunteer, both in the field and the lab, there are some techniques that overlap in fossil preparation, some tools that are similar, and it was very helpful to have Andrew as a volunteer. It's great to have volunteers in the lab in general. And then having had him as a volunteer, he was able to step into the paid position with a lot of experience, a lot of background. There's always more to learn, that goes for everybody, but having him had that background was a great help.
Excellent. For those of you just joining us, we're talking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Thomas Carr, who heads up the paleontology program at Carthage College, Dr. Megan Seitz, who is the primary preparator in the program, and Andrew Gable is with us as well, who is the new preparator for the program, having been hired. So he assists Dr. Seitz now in a paid position, having done so as a volunteer for some time before. Dr. Carr, since we're kind of looking backward here just a little bit, remind our listeners who have heard about this before, and for those who have not ever really heard much about this before at all, about these field expeditions that have occurred with the Carthage Paleontology Program. Remind us about where those have taken place and the kind of work that has been done in those expeditions.
Yeah, we're engaged with a long-term field research project in cooperation with Northern Illinois University and the Indiana University of Pennsylvania. We hold the permits to collect fossils there, so we're the primaries on this. The Dinosaur Discovery Museum is a federal repository, so we collect on public lands, not state or private lands. The American West is a checkerboard of those three types of land. And we have centuries of work ahead of us. Thankfully, we have several square miles of outcrop or badlands to discover new things, which we do every year. We have several active quarries that we keep going from one summer to the next. And this is concentrated in southeastern Montana, which is relatively unknown in terms of the big picture of the last million years of the age of dinosaurs. So it's an interesting area. There's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot to understand, which requires these collaborations with other institutions. But the bottom line is all the fossils we collect come back to Kenosha to stay, because the DDM is a federal repository. And since we collect on public lands, the fossils are here to stay in Kenosha for as long as the museum lasts.
Hmm. So you take these expeditions every other summer.
It's 2 years on, 1 year off, so it maps on to the J-term schedule of mine. So this summer we were off. I was able to do other things, and we're back on for 24 and 25. And our field season is a month, and we split that in half between the field course, which is the first 2 weeks, and the back end is for volunteers.
Very good. So Dr. Seitz, explain to our listeners the kind of fossils that we are talking about that that get extracted from the earth in these expeditions and gets taken back to Kenosha. I mean, I guess I'm asking, first of all, I think when we think about fossils, we think about big things that immediately look like fossils. And of course, as I remember from past conversations, that's not always, maybe that's not even often what we're talking about here. We're often talking about things that are much smaller, essentially fragments. Is that right?
Yes, we get quite a range. We get quite a range of animals. So as Dr. Carr said, we're looking at the last million years of the age of dinosaurs. So that means some of the most famous and important in their own way fossils, such as Triceratops, duck-billed dinosaurs, and, of course, everybody's favorite T-Rex. We often find single bones when we're talking dinosaurs like that. It's relatively rare in our area to find multiple bones together. It does happen. It's exciting when it does. So we might find a single leg bone, perhaps part of the spinal column, some foot bones, something like that. Then we find lots of other animals, again, range of sizes, range of completeness. We find lots of turtles. We joke that if you trip over something, it's probably a turtle, and it's probably a turtle next to that, and more fragments of turtle after that. And if you're in the lab with me, your second project will be a bag of turtle shell because it's ubiquitous. We also find crocodile fossils, lots of fish. That's probably the second most common after turtles is fish, especially scales and skull bones, mainly of a relative of the modern gar. Hmm. So they're very sturdy fossils that turn up in a lot of places. And then we even find teeth of lots of little animals, not just the dinosaur teeth, although we find lots of those, but also the crocodile teeth, even mammal teeth. Those are always very exciting because there were mammals living at the time of dinosaurs, mostly quite small, but some that were maybe more like an opossum. And we find a lot of those, or relatively speaking, among the mammals. We find some of those larger opossum-sized. And we find sometimes even rare things like bird fossils. They tend to be fragile, so we're excited when we find a bird fossil.
Wow. So Dr. Carr, at what point in this process does identification occur and is... is that something that you primarily do, or Dr. Seitz, or the two of you in consultation with each other? I mean, typically, at what point in this process do we know what a given fossil or fossil fragment is?
It depends. Generally, you get to recognize different dinosaurs in the ground. So Triceratops is pretty easy if there's skull bones, because there's nothing like Triceratops. Mm. So the IDs can happen in the field, but the main focus is in the fall. So after we're back from Montana, the two of us will just sit down and catalog everything. So part of the deal for collecting on public lands is that we submit an annual field report that includes a catalog of all the fossils that we find. And so we look at everything, and I mean everything. So there could be a bag full of fragments, and we sort through all of that to make sure that we have a pretty clear picture of what we've actually collected. So it takes months to get through thousands of fossils and catalog all of those. So that's when we might make discoveries after the fact. So a couple years ago, we found a complete foot bone of a bird that had broken into three pieces. We didn't know that to begin with, but we certainly did when those fragments dropped out of the bag, you know, in the lab. So the process starts on the field and wraps up in the lab.
Is it often or ever that you really don't know precisely what something is? I mean, are there some things that defy definitive identification?
It's pretty straightforward to narrow things down. Where things go dark for us is knowing the species. So the bird we knew was a bird, footbone, but we didn't know that it was part of a group of swimming birds called Hesperornithiforms. So in those cases, we reach out to expert colleagues for IDs, especially the birds and mammals. That's less so for other animals, but on occasion, yeah, if we're stumped and we think we've got a lizard or amphibian or what have you, we will reach out to colleagues. We don't tend not to, you know, depend on our imprecise IDs.
Sure. Dr. Seitz, is a preparator like you and Andrew, are you involved in that process of actually extracting a fossil out of the ground? Because, of course, sometimes they're firmly embedded and have to be removed. It's not just a matter of picking up something that's sitting on the ground. Do preparators do that, or does your part of this process come after that?
Many preparators do stay in the lab full time, and some of us, both me and Andrew included, are active in the field. So I'm out in Montana for those 4 weeks, the summers that we're out there, and that is what helps us do as much as we can, because if I'm out there, then I can lead a separate crew, that Dr. Carr, and we might be able to do more than if only one leader were out there. So I'm out helping to excavate the bones. If they're large enough and fragile enough, we'll put a plaster and burlap jacket on them to help secure them for the safe transport back to Kenosha. And it is a lot of heavy-duty work. It often takes a lot of digging, many hours in the hot sun, and that's why we have a great crew of both the students and the volunteers. And many of them come back year after year and get more experience each time and know how to tackle a hard project like making a jacket on a bone.
Yeah. Andrew, what are your memories of your first field experience out in Montana? And I'm especially curious to know what was surprising to you. I mean, in terms of what kind of work occurs in an exhibition like this.
Sure. excuse me. Well, to begin with, I was surprised by, for one, the remoteness of it. That was something that was very exciting to me. Being that isolated from civilization in that sense, that was really cool.
So the site of where this dig occurs is so far from
the
closest Denny's or whatever. I mean,
the nearest town was a town of just a few hundred, and it was about a good 40-minute drive on the vans, except from there to where we were staying. And I understand that my first year out there was the first year that we were actually able to use lodge to stay in rather than camping in tents. So I know that the energy around that was pretty positive the whole time I was out there. Everybody was pretty excited about that. But yeah, I had an inkling of what the actual work would have been. Partially just from what Drs. Carr and Seitz have talked about beforehand, and then just also from what I had read and everything. But yeah, just being out there and doing that was a fantastic experience. And I wouldn't say that there was much that necessarily surprised me very much, but just being able to do that for the first time was a great feeling.
Pretty exciting, I'm sure. Although, Dr. Seitz, it's probably important for people to understand that some of this work is probably in and of itself not particularly exciting. That is, we're talking about work that is incredibly meticulous and takes tons of time. I mean, give our listeners some sense of what we're talking about in terms of this exacting work.
Yes, in the field we have a lot of literal grunt work. We might be doing a lot of removing of overburden, so there might be a lot of rock and mud and clay and general debris over the fossils, so we have to dig those out sometimes with pick and shovel, and it might take many days before you see a tangible result of getting down to the layer where the fossils are. Then in the lab, it can be a lot of work, but it tends to be smaller, maybe a little more meticulous, working with little brushes, little picks. We have a wonderful machine that blasts a fine powder at the fossils that will gently clean off the dust. but it's still a lot of surface area. If you think about a turtle shell that then has been broken into pieces, you have all those edges that have to get cleaned up if you're going to be able to piece the entire thing back together accurately. So it can take a lot of detail work as well as just a lot of mental labor.
Wow. I hadn't even stopped to really think about that part of this, namely when we're talking about fragments, something that has been broken into pieces, the reassembling of it. And that is, it sounds like that is also something that you do. And do those pieces ultimately get reattached to each other?
Not always, certainly, but often, yes, especially if it's a more recent break with nice crisp edges. That's actually why I give turtle as a relatively beginner lab project, because it often breaks with those clean edges. They do go back together like a puzzle, but it's a more of a 2D puzzle, something more like a plate rather than a more complex shape like a leg bone. But we are often lucky enough to be able to piece something back together, maybe not 100%, but we certainly improve it. And you can get a much better sense of the shape of the overall fossil once you've done that.
So most of this work that you are doing is happening at the museum, is that correct?
Yes, so I am employed by Carthage, but I'm spending probably 98% of my time at the museum, and much of that is on public view.
Right, so there's no space at Carthage for this preparatory work to be done?
The lab and the fossil storage are all at the museum, partly because of the legalities of being a federal repository, and then that also has the space for the active work, yes.
Right. So describe what that space looks like.
At the museum, we're mostly in the basement, and we've got the gallery upstairs and some other displays of our fossils where we are trying to make things accessible and available to the public. Then in the basement, we have a fairly small room, or at least it's gotten a lot smaller once you put a lot of large dinosaur bones in it. And that is where we have the windows so the public can see in, and we've got most of the tools in there and some storage because we have overflowed our storage room. So we have another room that's probably a little larger than the lab, but it's full to bursting with all of the fossils we've brought back over the years. So most of the work that's visible is being done, of course, in the lab where we have most of the tools. We've got the protective equipment to keep all of the dust and the fumes away from the people who are working. And then we also have a few things that are available on display so that people can see that work in action.
Very good. So Dr. Carr and Dr. Seitz chime in. What determines what we're working on next? In terms of this large repository of bones, it sounds like there's almost more than you are able to deal with. I mean, there's probably kind of a waiting list. What determines kind of the prioritization of dealing with these bones versus these bones?
Right. So, and as part of my function of director of the Carthage Institute of Paleontology, I'll tend to set the default priorities, and those will depend on things like my own research interests. So if there's T-Rex material, that will float to the top of the list right away. And in terms of other fossils, we have a locality of a juvenile Triceratops, and they're relatively rare, so that's been a priority. And then, you know, my preference list is quickly dissolved by Dr. Seitz's realization of what's actually feasible given person power in the lab. And so I think our interests complement each other quite well. So for example, as part of Andrew's progression of training, he's currently working on a Triceratops snout. And that's something I was involved in collecting back whenever that was. And so I have an interest in seeing that one on the slate as well. And maybe Dr. Seitz can fill in a bit about that.
Yeah.
So partly because of the space concerns, we can't always have everybody working on a Triceratops skull, or at least not if we couldn't fit five different Triceratops skulls in the lab at once. So we might have one for Andrew, and then someone else might be working on turtle, especially if they're new. So we'll rotate the projects depending on both what Dr. Carr has prioritized and what's, like he said, practically possible within the lab. And that skull part that was found in 2015 is what Andrew has been working on, and he took over from somebody who worked on it last spring and has now moved on. So we try to keep things going, and hopefully in the next few weeks we're going to be making some significant progress.
Very good. So Andrew, for instance, I don't know if the last day you worked at the museum was Friday, but whenever you last worked at the museum, how long a day are we talking about, and what did you do? I mean, were you doing essentially the same thing from the moment you walked in the door to the moment you walked out?
I'll talk about last Friday specifically, but then also just general days, because it does vary a little bit. One of the stipulations of my job at the museum is that I can only work up to 28 hours a week there. That's one of the stipulations of the grant from the BLM. My schedule does vary a little bit, and it's going to vary more. I'm actually auditing one of Dr. Carr's classes now, and that's in the middle of kind of the time blocks. Now I'm showing up a little bit earlier and staying a little bit later. Fridays are typically a half day for me. This past week, I did spend all of Friday working on that Triceratops snout that they mentioned. What I've been spending most of my time doing with that has been hard cleaning. So I take an air scribe. It kind of works like a miniature jackhammer. It's got like a rotating metal point, and you use that to chip away hard stone on top of where the bone is. And in this particular jacket, there has been a big pile of ironstone that I've just been chipping away flake by flake. We did lift up pretty large chunk of that last time, so that's pretty significant progress there. I broke off about a fist-sized chunk of it, and we realized that there was a layer of mudstone between that and the bone itself. We were worried about, if we were to lift that up, damaging the actual bone underneath, but we determined that wouldn't be an issue, so we were able to get most of that out of the way. There is another pile of that elsewhere in the jacket that I'm going to have to continue to chip away at, but yeah, that there has been significant progress with that. We're getting closer and closer to the bone. I haven't started much work on this yet, but Dr. Seitz also did recently give me a Triceratops syncervical in some dinosaurs. That's a fusion of some of the cervical vertebrae. That's also in a jacket. I believe that was also collected by Dr. Carr. And then also frill fragments. And there were some other things I've finished in the past, but those are the ones that are on rotation currently.
Very good. Dr. Seitz, he touched on the fact that you don't want things, obviously, to be damaged. How serious a concern is that, and how much does that affect what you do and how you do it?
We certainly try to work cautiously whenever possible. You know, these bones have been around for over 60 million years, depending on where exactly we found them, so we don't want to make them any worse than they already are. They've endured enough. And so we're trying to improve them, not damage them any further. So in the specific case Andrew was talking about, we really, really wanted to get that awful ironstone out, but we couldn't tell initially if it was resting on the bone, and if we were to rip it out very roughly, it might have taken some bone with it and possibly beyond repair. And so we didn't want to risk that until we were sure that there was no direct contact, which is what we determined on Friday. Sometimes things do happen. That's why I start new people out with something that's maybe already broken. So if they break it just a little bit more, it's not too bad. But we do make every effort to treat the bones with care, and if something does happen, to rectify the situation right away.
And by the way, who are we talking, I don't mean by name, but who are we talking about in general when it comes to these volunteers that are engaged in some of this work at the museum?
We've had a diverse group over the years. Certainly, we try to get Carthage students in if they're interested and available. Sometimes it is a little difficult if they're trying to get to the museum from campus. If they don't have a ride, that can make things a little more difficult, unfortunately. But we do try for Carthage students when we can. We also have lots of different volunteers from around the Carthage community, or even coming in from Milwaukee and Lake Geneva. They've got a young lady coming in from Lake Geneva this year. And they might just have an interest in dinosaurs, maybe a little bit of free time. I've had people who were volunteers, people who were retired and came in as volunteers to kind of do something fun with their lives. And we've had retired paramedics, retired pipe fitters from the old Nash factory. And it's always great to get different perspectives, people with different backgrounds.
Wonderful. For those of you just joining us, we're talking today with Dr. Thomas Carr from the paleontology program at Carthage, the founder and director of it, Dr. Megan Seitz, who has been the primary preparator of the program since 2011, and Andrew Gable, who was recently hired as a second preparator, and we're finding out about the work that they do. Dr. Carr, I know that one of the things that you were excited to talk about today was an article of yours that has recently been published. And I have to say, I took it, I began to read it, and was just kind of astonished at how little I could understand of any of it. I mean, it just reminded me of what a specialized field this is, and about the fascinating things that you uncover that the rest of us just don't begin to comprehend. The title of it, A Reappraisal of Tyrannosauroid Fossils from the Iren Dabasu Formation, Inner Mongolia, People's Republic of China. And it sounds like it is an article that kind of talks about how we look at things and we have to interpret them carefully. Tell us in your own words more about what this article explores.
It's basically a comparative study of Tyrannosaur legs and feet, and based on fossils collected in China, what's now China, back in the 1920s, during the Asiatic expeditions of the American Museum of Natural History. Way back then, the director of paleontology, Henry Fairfield Osborne, teamed up with Roy Chapman Andrews, his field person, to start a series of long-term expeditions to China to look for the origins of people. That was actually Osborne's goal. And turns out he was completely wrong about that. But Andrews, in the meantime, found sort of the treasure trove of dinosaur fossils that Inner and Outer Mongolia are now completely famous for. And in the first couple years out there, Andrew's crew picked up the leg, which is the main focus of the article, and that was the foundation for the comparative study. The leg belongs to an animal called Electrosaurus, which means unmarried lizard. And when I first saw that back during my PhD years, it was obvious that it was a tyrannosaur, but very different from all others. Sort of all its joints were strangely expanded, and still not quite sure what that means. The year before that, a partial tyrannosaur skull was found with some teeth. It was not found with the leg. They were found quite a distance apart. And that was never described in the literature. So as part of my PhD, I took the opportunity to redescribe the osteology of the leg and write up the skull as well. And so those were published together in June. And so it took a long time to get that chapter published, but I'm very happy that it's out there now.
Absolutely. And by the way, my eyes lit up when you mentioned the name Roy Chapman Andrews, because I think a lot of us, if we have had an interest in dinosaurs, at least if you're as old as I am, might very well stem from one of the books that he wrote. And I can remember reading myself to sleep with some of his really fascinating work.
Yeah, in fact, when I was a kid, I had his, I think it's one of his kids' books through Scholastic. It was one of those very thin ones. I think it was called, All About Dinosaurs, and that was an Andrews book. So, yeah, he's been or was a very important figure in the history of our science.
Absolutely.
Particularly with Asia. Yeah.
So we were going to have two students with us who ultimately did not appear, but I want to give you a chance to just talk about the work that that they have been doing. First of all, for the sake of a listener who doesn't understand what a SURE grant is, explain what that is.
Right. So Carthage has something called the Summer Undergraduate Research Experience, which is a pot of money in place for students across campus to participate in original research on campus that's helmed by a faculty. This year I applied for three SURE positions. I landed two. And so just a bit of backstory for this is every fall there's an international meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. And last fall I realized that it really makes no sense to have my students wait till their junior year to start their research projects. That's the way I've had it set up for some time. And I realized, you know, if we're going to be competitive, we've really got to accelerate this process. And so we did that. So I had two freshmen, Joseph Krikora and Maverick Lear, do 10-week projects. So the sure thing is 10 weeks. And they worked on growth in sea scorpions. So Maverick Lear's project was focused on extinct marine sea scorpions, the relatives of scorpions. They aren't scorpions in and of themselves, but they look like it. And Joseph worked on the growth of a particular bowfin fish, a dogfish, you know, called Cyclurus, which is extinct, but it's a close relative of the living Amia, which is bowfin, which is found in the Great Lakes Basin. And the cool part about Joseph's project was that he worked on fossils that we collected from Montana. So we collect a whole bunch of jawbones. For some reason, jawbones of fish preserve relatively frequently, and he went through all of those to identify the species. And we focused in on Cyclurus because its sample size was pretty high, over 120 fossils. And so at the end of Sure, they both were able to recover growth series for both of their species. And
sort of trace the line.
Yeah, so just to add to what Maverick was doing with the scorpions, he actually went to the Field Museum and Milwaukee Public Museum to study actual fossils, so that they're both working with actual data. And what they do is they identify growth variable features. You know, could be, you know, size, could be a position of a hole or the texture of a joint surface, something like that. And they code that out and use a software package to recover the pattern in the data. And that maps onto growth. And they're both able to do that. And they will be presenting their results as posters on campus September 11th. I think that's next Monday. So the campus community will have a chance to see the results of their work. And this has never been done for those species before. So it's truly original work.
Wow.
And although there's some work done on sea scorpion growth in the literature, there's nothing for the bowfins. So Joseph's work is completely original. So he's discovered growth changes that no one ever knew about before.
Wow.
Which is pretty exciting.
Were these topics something to which you directed them?
Yes.
Okay. So you had a sense that this was fertile ground for some good work to be done.
Yeah, so in terms of just the way the program works, I meet with every paleo student in their freshman year and discuss sort of the long view of their 4 years at the college, and we also discuss candidate species for their research projects. And Joseph has an interest in fish, particularly sharks. Obviously, bowfins aren't sharks, but he was happy enough with those. We find very few shark fossils. We do find some, but not enough to do anything with those. And Maverick is actually our first invertebrate student. And the way I approach the study of growth can be done for any organism. So it was just a great opportunity for Maverick to help expand the offerings of our program. So, I mean, if people are interested in invertebrates, that's fine. There's a place for them here at Carthage. We're not exclusively focused on backboned animals.
Very good. So Dr. Seitz, Maverick and Joseph doing this work, I assume it was being done where you work, in the lab?
Joseph's was, because he was working
Right.
Yes, so since I didn't have any, I unfortunately did not have any sea scorpions for Maverick to work on, that would be all kinds of awesome if we were to find one in Montana in the Cretaceous.
Right. So, yeah, so he was doing his work in Milwaukee, but otherwise Joseph was there on hand, and so.
Yes, so for the majority of the 10 weeks of the SURE program, Joseph was doing his research on specimens that we collect from Montana that are housed in the museum, and he was physically on site. He was in the lab where people who came to the museum could see him doing his research through those windows. So for the summer, we actually had an extra living exhibit of a type that we had someone doing measurements, doing research, looking up things in books and articles, and doing a different kind of science than we often have on view. And now that he's gone through so many of our fish fossils, now we have a much better idea of what we have. Where before we could have said, in general, we have some bowfin fossils, now we have most of them identified down to the species, which is amazing.
Right. So people can actually come and watch you through the window. That's actually something I've never taken the opportunity to do. So do very many people seize that opportunity?
I think not everybody knows that it's there, but when they do know, they're very excited. And I can tell when someone comes down to the basement and initially maybe thinks there's no one there and is disappointed, but then maybe comes at a different angle or sees the flash of the white lab coat, and then, mommy, there's someone really here. And there's a lot of excitement and just seeing real science done by real people.
Right. So Andrew is one of the people being looked at. I bet that's kind of fun for you.
Yeah, I was actually... going to say we're working on Dawn, the Triceratops snout. I'm on the floor doing that because it's such a big jacket, and that's behind desks, so a lot of times people can't see me, but they can hear like the roar of the air scribe. But they might not necessarily know where that's coming from or what that is. But yeah, if I'm doing some piecing or air abrasion or something like that, where I'm on the table, people can see me. They sometimes give me a little wave. Sometimes people will knock on the window a little bit, and I can come over if they have any questions for me or anything like that, too.
Very, very good. So we hope that people hearing this are going to take advantage of the opportunity to make their way into the basement of the Dinosaur Discovery Museum and see the work of Dr. Megan Seitz and Andrew Gable and various volunteers. At a given point in time, how many volunteers are we talking about that might be there?
At a given point in time, there's probably only maximum two or three people in the lab if Andrew and I are both there and one other volunteer, and that's just limits of space, of working space, and of the tools. But throughout the year, I might have at least 10 different people at different times.
Fantastic.
And I did want to tell one story very quickly, if I can, which is one of my favorite visitor interactions was when I was talking to a little girl outside of the lab, because sometimes if someone's interested, I'll come out and talk to you if you're really interested in what I'm doing. So we'd been talking for a little while, and she said, you know, I can tell you're a real scientist. And I said, oh, is it because I'm wearing a lab coat? Because I usually do.
Yeah.
It's very useful to keep the dust off your clothes. And she said, no, it's because it's dirty. Because it probably was. So we're doing real science. We get down in the dirt. We're working with the real objects. It's not just for show.
I like that a lot. If somebody is interested in the possibility of becoming a volunteer or it just wants to know more about it, is there a preferred way for them to contact you?
Probably the best way is through email, either for Dr. Carr or myself, or if they get in touch with the museum, they'll also know how to contact us.
Very good. Well, I'm sure you're always looking for new, enthusiastic volunteers like that young person who appreciated the dirt on your lab coat. Dr. Megan Seitz, preparator for the paleontology program, and Andrew Gable, the new hire, the assistant preparator. Nice to meet you, Andrew, and we're so glad that you could be here on the morning show with Dr. Seitz. Great to catch up with
you.
And Dr. Thomas Carr is... wonderful, as always, to talk with you, and congratulations on all that has been accomplished with the paleontology program thus far, and I'm sure you are excited about future possibilities, and we thank you for being part of the morning show once again.
Thanks very much.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm going to be speaking with Mike Rose, the author of an interesting book called Why School? Reclaiming Education for All of Us. On Thursday, another Carthage faculty member, Dr. Art Sear, joins us for his monthly visit to the program. On Friday, Fern Schumer-Chapman, author of Like Finding My Twin, in which she tells the amazing story about how her mother and her best friend, who barely escaped the Holocaust and were almost immediately separated from one another once reaching America, were able to be reunited over 70 years later. An incredible true story, which we'll hear about on Friday's morning show. Today's going to be partly sunny, hot and humid, a high of 91 degrees, heat index of 95. Partly cloudy overnight, a 40% chance of rain, a low of 73. Partly sunny tomorrow and not quite as hot, a high of 86 degrees. Thursday, look at this, partly cloudy and a high of 69. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway.